a man and his wife walked into a bank, an older couple, been married a while, and the wife looked very bitter, and the husband looked defeated, and her arms were like this, and she said, they were crossed, and she said, "I've given you the best years of my life. You've got no drive, no ambition. That's your trouble." And just then, in the bank, the doors fly open, and bandits walk in. And they say, "This is a holdup." And they grab the woman by the neck and pull her away. And everyone puts their hands up. And he says, "If anyone moves, she gets it." And the man goes, that was a British comedy skit, and I was sent that as a video, as a text this week on our anniversary. We joke sometimes. So we say we've had 12 wonderful years together, and we've been married 15. Well, a wedding, in fact, is usually a wonderful time. It's full of feelings of goodness and of things that are just a time of celebration. When a couple comes together, it's because they want to be together. And their hearts are filled with delight in each other. And there's a feeling of, with the couple, that the day has finally come. It's finally here. And we get to be together. There's an amazing embrace of togetherness. And often the bride will say something towards the end of the day like, "It was a perfect day." At least that's what she says to her dad. And often it is. But sometimes, while we want to make the day perfect, sometimes it isn't. Sometimes at a wedding, the expectations are very high. And there can be tensions over the details, over the planning, over who does what, and when, and how. And sometimes, even with those normal tensions that happen with the planning and the execution of it, there are sometimes big blunders. I was at a wedding and I was in the wedding party when the groom's tuxedo, when he put it on, he realized that there was a separation in the seam right down his leg. And it was maybe 18 inches. And we had to do something about this. That would have been a big blunder for him to have a big separation in his pants. And just in time, we found a sewing kit. We were able to fix that seam. Well, there was a big blunder in our passage today. The big blunder happened at a wedding. Now, this is a bit of Jesus' biography according to one of his followers named John, one of his disciples. And in this biography, John chooses to take certain sections of Jesus' life so that he can present him so that we can know from selected days in his life and things that happened, we can know who he is and what he has done. Well, on this day, Jesus, and it tells us Jesus and his mother and his disciples were at a wedding in a town called Cana in Galilee. And the blunder happens. They run out of wine. This is the third day of the wedding. His mother comes and she tells him the big problem. She comes to Jesus and she says, "They have no wine." And I picture it as her coming to him and saying, "They have no wine. Like, so do something." Okay? Now, this is a big problem for this couple and for this wedding because the groom was expected to provide for all of his guests at this feast. In the Middle East, the cultures of the Middle East put an incredibly high value on hospitality. And that means that if you invite people to your feast, you must feed them until they are full. And if your feast lasts for 3 or 7 days or somewhere in there, then you have to have enough food and you have to have enough wine to keep them full, keep them fed and happy the whole time. This is day 3 and they run out. If the party runs out of wine, if it would have run out of wine for them, it would have been an awful start for this young couple. It would have been a social disaster. There would have been a stigma on them, especially connected with the memory of this feast for their wedding. So the bottom line is this, that we have to understand. You don't throw a feast and then run out of wine. Major faux pas. Major problem. But Mary went to Jesus for help. And if we read it quickly, we can see he did help. But first he rebukes her. First he says, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My time, my hour has not yet come." First, now, a little note, I've shared this before. Unless you're the Son of God, don't address your mother as woman. I think he did this in a with a loving tone. I think he certainly loved Mary, but it's clearly a rebuke. Literally in the Greek, he says, "What is this to you and to me?" You know, like you would say in Northern Jersey, "What are you talking about? Get out of here!" Or what does this have to do with me? Okay. So he rebukes her. Now, if you hadn't read this before and you get to this point in the story, you might think that the story ends here. Like, it's over. They had a little, you got a little glimpse into an adult son and his mother having a little conversation on the side at a wedding. And that was it. But there's a twist. There's a twist. After he says this to her, she turns to some servants. And when she turns to these servants, she goes to them. And she tells them something that's strange. Doesn't tell us how many servants, but she gets the servants and she says, "Servants, do whatever he tells you to do." And then I can just sort of picture Mary stepping back. By the way, her words to those servants, several commentators point out, are the greatest instructions you could ever get. This man from Nazareth, Jesus, we are to do whatever he tells you. And in that, there are rich blessings. We must submit ourselves completely to him because his ways are always best beyond our understanding. And you think about these servants, they had no clue what they're doing. They had no clue the plan that God had and their part in it. They were simply obeying. So her instruction to them is the greatest advice you could ever get, the greatest counsel. Well, then things happen. Something amazing happens. Things get really just amazing, to keep using the same word. Up to this point in Jesus' life, only a few people were following him. But nobody knows fully who he is, really who he is. The disciples had a sort of head knowledge about him. Just a couple days before, they're talking with each other and they're saying, "Could this be the Messiah?" And they say, "Well, let's go and follow him. Let's find out." And they have sort of a head knowledge that, yeah, this is the Messiah. And John the Baptist is pointing to him as such. The servants at the wedding, however, there's no indication that they have any clue who he is. Just a man who's a teacher with some of his students at a wedding feast. And I suspect, though, that based on her reliance, that Mary knows something of Jesus' ability to help in a situation like this. Mary was given plenty of clues along the way, wasn't she? I mean, an angel talked to her. She got pregnant in a unique way to her husband, to Anna, and to people at the temple, and to Elizabeth and Zechariah. And these things were happening, especially in the early life of this couple, that revealed to her something about him. So Mary tells the servants to do what he tells them to do. And then I just kind of imagine Mary sort of stepping back with maybe a smirk on her face, like, "I know something good is going to happen." Mary would be in her 40s at this point. And Jesus gives a mundane job to these servants. He says, "Fill up the water jars." Now, these were ceremonial washing jars, and they're 20 to 30 gallons each. Okay, so in my mind, I try to picture that. You know what a 50-gallon drum looks like? If you cut that somewhere between those two middle rings, and then you make it a little bit wider and a little bit curvy because it's a stone jar that's cut out, there are six of these big jars. And he tells them to fill them up. And they did their job. They filled the six jars, it says, to the top, to the brim. And then he says, draw some water. No, he doesn't say water. He says, draw some and give it to the master of the feast. Now, this, for these servants, would be strange. Okay, the servants would have noticed. Now, if one of us came from Pennsylvania, and we went to the Middle East, and we said, let's use some of that bathing water for ceremonial purposes to fill up the cups, they would say, you know, it's not really used for that. But Jesus is from Galilee. He grew up in this area. He's a local. Okay, just a few miles from Nazareth, they're in Cana. But it's strange, it had to have been strange for the servants, because this stuff is for by the door. It's for washing your hands and your feet. It's to make you ceremonially clean. It isn't drinking water. And again, my imagination, I just picture Mary in the background. Like the servants, they were just told by Mary, do whatever he tells you, that now they're maybe going, like checking over at Mary, and she's going, go do it. I said, whatever he tells you. I don't know if that. It's not in the story. But they did it. Okay? They did it. And the master of the feast tastes this, doesn't know where it comes from, and his response is, wow, this is great. This is the good stuff. And he calls the groom, who is the founder of the feast, okay? The groom is providing all this. And he pulls to him the groom, and the master of the feast is working for the groom. He was a guy that was the guy that kept the party going. He was hired to keep the party going, and he runs the feast, sort of like a master of ceremonies. But he's the guy that makes sure that they're having fun, and he's telling them, all right, let's do the Hava Nagila. Let's do the now we're gonna circle around, and we're gonna have another round of fill up your glasses. That's his job. But he pulls the groom, and he says to him, basically, he said, best party ever. He says, everyone serves the good wine first. And then when the people have drunk freely, then they serve the poor wine. Okay, so normally people start with the Di Giovanna. Okay, we have some people connected with a vineyard in Sicily. That's the good wine. Normal parties, start with that. Then get the stuff you bought at the gas station. Serve that later. And this is the logic in the mind of this man. He says, this is great, though. I mean, things got really good now. And I can't help but think, again, of what the servants must have done. I mean, the experience, it points out specifically that the servants knew what was happening. And I can't help but think of what the servants must have done. Whenever the master of the party realizes this is great wine, and they had just filled this with water and then brought a cup of it to him, did they raise their gaze enough to glance over at Jesus? And if they did, I wonder if he gave them kind of a knowing smile or a wink or whatever he would do to be like, isn't that great? And maybe back in the kitchen, they're talking and they're saying, how did he do that? Who is he? Hey, would you try some? Well, I had to make sure it was safe. The servants knew what happened. Okay, we don't know the conversation or what happened in the kitchen or wherever. But the passage points out that they knew what happened and that this was a sign. Okay? So the party, which was almost a disaster, now was filled with blessings. It was filled with blessing. And this little day in John's biography of Jesus ends with these words. This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory. And the disciples believed in him. This is what we would call a miracle, and it was. But John calls it a sign. The other three Gospels refer to acts of power when Jesus does miracles, or they just refer to them as miracles. And the other three Gospels all have kind of a same way of talking about miracles, that they are calling people to faith, but in a different way. Those three are revealing that the kingdom of God has come, and it's coming with power. Here, the Greek word is semeion, and John uses seven signs in his gospel. And a sign is something that points to something else. And so the purpose of these signs, which were miracles, is to point to who he really is. That Jesus does these things, these incredible things, and they reveal something about who he really is. The sign points to a greater reality of who Jesus is, what he's all about. This is called the first sign. And the word for first could mean primary or basic or fundamental, foundational. This was an amazing miracle. But what does it tell us about Jesus? Well, he's able to change this water into wine. And the passage points out two things about the wine itself. How good it is. I mean, this is the best. How good it is and how abundant it is. Its goodness and its fullness. Notice the two points there. We can see that he caused it to be of great quality and of great quantity. Now this is, again, pointing us to tell us something about Jesus. It was a way of revealing his glory. And what do we mean when we say glory? When we talk about glory, when this passage is talking about glory, it's talking about the splendor, the honor of who he really is. It's when you get a glimpse of who, of what he's done, of what that means he is, of who he is, you look at it and you say, wow, he is amazing. You know, his disciples saw this, he revealed his glory, they got a glimpse of who he is, and they said, wow, you know, I knew we should hook up our wagon. Follow him. We definitely should. I mean, he is the guy. They saw the excellence of who he is. Notice that his glory had to be revealed. It uses the term that he revealed it. You know, earlier in this book, the passage says that he was in the world and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He was passing by people all the time on the street, and it wasn't like he was glowing. He just looked like another guy. Most people didn't know who he really was or is. John the Baptist said in the last chapter, I came that he might be revealed. The disciples can say back in chapter 1, verse 14, we have seen his glory. But it is not a natural thing to see his glory, to see Jesus' glory. It is something that must be revealed. God must reveal it to you. And how does he reveal it? Well, he reveals it through showing us, through the proclamation of the gospel, who he is, what he has done. When his follower Peter, called Simon Peter, told Jesus, when Jesus asked, who do people say that I am? He says, well, they say this, they say that. Who do you say that I am? Peter said, you're the Messiah. That's who you are. You're the Christ. And Jesus said something interesting to him at that point. They're in Caesarea Philippi. And Jesus says to him, he says, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven has revealed this to you. God had to reveal this to his disciples who were living with him and following him all over the place. Jesus chose to reveal his glory to them at this wedding and to these servants. It must be revealed to you. How does God reveal it? Through the proclamation of who Jesus is and what he has done. That is the point of this book. The point of this book of John is to show the things that Jesus has done, the things that he taught, who he is, what he has done, so that people can hear the open proclamation of the gospel and believe. And it says that we're doing the same thing in 1 Corinthians 4, that through the open statement of the truth, we proclaim Jesus. That's what we do. And whenever anyone hears this message of Jesus, even the smallest glimpse of who he is, the scriptures point out that if you have this desire to be saved, to know him, to know his goodness, and you call on his name, that you will be saved. It's an incredible God. You might not have to get the whole picture, but Jesus gave a little glimpse, and they believed. Well, notice to whom his glory was revealed. It was to the disciples of Jesus, and it was to the servants who were at the feast, not to the master of the feast. And there's a contrast that we see between the master and the servants. I think it's interesting. Now, it doesn't say that the master never believed, but he doesn't in this. And the glory of this sign was not revealed to the master. The goodness of the wine was. So one point we can take from this is that some people are close enough that they can taste the goodness of Jesus, but never connect that goodness with his glory. That goodness is because of the person of Jesus, who he is, and so they do not believe. It was not known to the master of the feast, but to the servants. The word there is diakonoi, the deacons, the servants, the household servants, who were, you know, cutting up the fruit and scooping up the wine and serving it. It was known to them and to his disciples. They got a glimpse of his glory. It was a glimpse that was only for a few. And Jesus was revealing himself slowly. So I want to make another point. You come to Jesus only if God reveals Jesus' glory to you. And that's the point of why the Gospel of John is written. It's so that we can hear it. We could either read it or hear it, read or proclaimed, and we can believe that he is the Christ, that he's the Messiah, the Son of God. Now, Mary knew that Jesus could help. And in this account on this day, when the problem comes up, Mary goes to him for help. She had raised him and she had spent 30 years with him. At this point, he's beginning his public ministry. And can you imagine how reliable he must have been? A son who never sins. Amazing. I think about my childhood. I sinned. I think about my sons. And anyway, I wonder how she came to know that Jesus could fix this. Perhaps there were times in Nazareth when people had similar needs, certain needs that Jesus would just solve. He could find a solution like nobody else could. But we don't know. It doesn't say. But she knew that she could rely on him, and she did. But it's interesting because Jesus rebukes her. He says to her, "Woman, my hour has not yet come. What does this have to do with me?" He rebukes her. So we have to ask, what did he mean when he said that to her? He said, "My hour has not yet come." And as we'll see through this gospel, Jesus keeps referring to his hour. And what does that mean? It's the hour when he is supremely glorified. And he is specifically talking about the time when he will die on a cross and then after 3 days come to life again. That hour is the time of his supreme glorification. When he wasn't just revealing his glory to a few at a wedding feast, but it was done on a cross openly outside the city of Jerusalem, so that all could know exactly what happened and hear it clearly proclaimed. At that point, God most fully displayed his glory. When the certainty of that hour is when the certainty of the messianic age is secured and it is displayed. Talking about the messianic age, we're talking about what we read in Isaiah 25 earlier. When the age of wine, representing the blessings of goodness, will flow in abundance for God's people. When He will wipe away tears from every face, when there won't be evil oppression, when there won't be suffering and lack and want. All of that will be done, and he will take away the veil that is over every person on this world. It'll all be gone. All the evil, all the bad things. The messianic age then, at that hour when he died on the cross, it was shown to be stripped away, that he won a victory over that, and that he would secure this messianic age. So his hour in this book, in the Gospel of John, is the time when he would die on the cross to sacrifice himself for our sin. In that hour, he took away sin, which is what separates us from him, so that we could be united to him. You know, the hardest part about an engagement time is that a fiancé, the soon-to-be bride and groom, they just can't be together. And they long to be together. And they're waiting to be together. But there's a time of waiting. And whenever it's done, it's so good. And you just get to be together. Well, the final reality of all who trust in Jesus is guaranteed by the cross and the resurrection. It's like whenever a man gets on his knee and he asks a woman to marry him. And he gives her a ring. This is what we do in our culture. I guess in other cultures you get it like a cow or something. But he gives her a gift. Okay? He gives her a gift and he says, this is guaranteeing that we will be together. And when Jesus died on the cross, that's what he did. That was his hour. His hour means our salvation. It is guaranteed and it is accomplished. This supreme hour of glory displayed is openly proclaimed to all so that all who believe will be saved. So I want you to notice one more thing about this passage because of this. If you read over it quickly, you might miss it. But how the passage begins, it says, on the third day, there was a wedding in Cana. On the third day. And if you notice, John is counting up days at the beginning of this gospel. First, John the Baptist shows up on the scene. And then it says in verse 29 of chapter 1, the next day, and then verse 35, the next day, and then 43, the next day. So you have, it starts, the next day, the next day, the next day. You've got four so far. And then the beginning of this, it says, on the third day. And so what he's saying is, count three more. Okay, add three to that. And what we've got is this miracle happens on a seventh day. So John is counting up these days. And we have to ask, why is he doing that? And why is he pointing out these days and how many days it took? And we have to pay close attention to this. This sign happened on the seventh day. In John chapter 1, verse 1, it says, in the beginning was the Word. Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning, God created. Bereshit Elohim. What John is saying is that this 7 days that he is pointing out with Jesus is in parallel to what happened in Genesis at the beginning. The Creator made the heavens and the earth. Well, what's happening with Jesus here in what he did? He's showing us that God is doing something again. Jesus is God the Creator, and he is making his new creation. The Creator is recreating. He's the one who can speak words and say, let there be, and there will be. He can say, fill up water jars, and without even a word, without anything else, he can change that into wine. Of course he can. If he is in fact God, of course he can make wine. Grapes had to come from somewhere. God spoke the creation into existence, and Jesus is the Creator now recreating. He took 6 jars, and people have pointed out that this shows the insufficiency of man or the insufficiency of the law. And he made an abundance of goodness by recreating. That water was intended to cleanse. It was an outward thing. The heart of a person was not cleansed by the water. Hands were cleansed, feet were cleansed, so that you wouldn't eat with unclean, unwashed hands. But Jesus, who transformed that water into wine, is the one who can transform, period. And if he can transform water into wine, he can transform you. And he can transform anyone who believes in him, who catches a glimpse of his glory. You see, the sign points to something. And the point of this sign is that he is the creator. And he's recreating with abundance and with amazing goodness beyond anything you've ever tasted. He has transforming power. And what he makes, friends, is good. And this comes right down to who you are and who I am. He has this effect on all who trust in him now. I don't know if you've seen the movie I Can Only Imagine. I won't spoil it for you, but there's a character in there. And the big thing in this movie is that God's power of coming to know Jesus really does change lives. If you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. I won't spoil it for anyone else. Go see it. One commentator said this: the modest water saw its God and blushed. And here is something that we need to realize from this passage. They saw his glory, it says. The disciples saw his glory, and they started putting their faith in him. They were believing in him now. They were trusting in him in a new way with their lives. If you behold God, you will not be the same. You will be changed. It says in 2 Corinthians 5:17 that, therefore, if anyone is in Christ, that person is a new creation. The old has gone. The new has come. You know what was in those jars? It wasn't water anymore. It was wine. It was changed. The essence of what it was changed. And that's what he does when anyone turns to him. You are changed from the inside. The very essence of who you are is different. In 2 Corinthians 3:18, it says that for Christians, we are still being changed. How? It says that we who behold his glory, when we look at him with the scriptures, with the proclamation of the gospel, as Christians, we who behold his glory are being transformed. We are changed and we are being changed into his image. He makes us like him. Amazingness of who he is. We get to be more and more like him, uniquely as he's created each one of us to be, but also all of us like him in all the best ways. And one day the veil will be gone, sin will be gone, and we who trust in Christ, we will be forever glorified with him in his presence. We are not the same. The recreation begins now, and the Creator is changing people. God is calling people then to a feast. You know, some people think that if I come to Christ, if I become a Christian, I'm going to give up. I have to start living a life of, you know, don't drink, smoke, chew, whatever, dance with girls who do, something like that. I have to give up all my fun. But he's inviting us to a feast. I mean, the master of the feast said this, basically, I'm just paraphrasing, best party ever. You saved the good stuff until now. I love my job. And he went away with that. What God is inviting us to is reflected in those words. It's a party. The very message which calls us to trust in God, in Christ, is called the gospel. It's a message of good news. It's like so many of us just living in this area. When the Eagles actually did it, I mean, people were yelling and jumping and screaming, and Facebook lit up. Or whatever it was, social media. It means good news. We wake up our kids the next morning. The Eagles did it. It's good news. God is calling us to a celebration. You know, and it's going to come. The day's going to come when it will be fully realized in a celebration. There will be a day of a great feast. In Revelation 19, it talks about the marriage supper of the Lamb. And on that day, we will have all the joy of his embrace, all the joy of his sufficiency, everything that we ever need, fully realize we'll be with him. And the wine will flow, and it will be good wine, better than anything in this world. No more running out of good things, no more crying there. He will wipe away every tear from every eye. And whenever he had his last supper with his disciples, he said something to them. He said, look, I'm telling you guys something. I want to tell you this. From this moment on, I will not drink wine. I'm not going to drink the fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it with you anew in my Father's kingdom with you. You see, he's the groom, and he's the one that provides for the great feast. And the great day of that feast is coming. And we are waiting for that day. And he is calling us to this. Now, here's the message. You might be here. Most of us are Christians who are here. And we know what this is all about. And we know what that day is that we're looking forward to. And we know the goodness of it right now. Look at the words again of the master of the feast. He says, man, everyone serves the good stuff first. And then they serve the cheap stuff. But you have kept the good wine until now. And so the groom got credit for doing something that maybe he did. I mean, obviously he wasn't a great planner. So maybe he just sat back and said, well, I'm glad you like it. The point is this. He realized the goodness of this wine. He realized the goodness, even if he didn't see the glory of Christ in it. Those words from that master of ceremonies, that master of the feast, is what it is like to come to trust in Jesus. It's waking up to the goodness of who he is, the fullness, the goodness, the beauty. It's realizing, yeah, this is the best. This is where I want to be. And this shows us the difference between living the best you can without Jesus versus living with him. Even in this world, only with him is life truly good right now. In Psalm 16:11, it says, God, in your presence there is fullness of joy, and at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. The point is that there is plenty of it, and it is good. We're talking about God's grace for us, God's welcoming embrace. It was true of the wine. There was so much of it, and it was incredibly good. And this is true of Jesus' goodness for you. It is plenty for you for all your days and for all eternity. It says in John 1:16, from his fullness we have all received grace. And it says in our passage, his disciples put their faith in him. The point is for us to hear these things so that we can taste and see that the Lord is good. He really is good. It's the best. There's nothing that is better if it is away from him. And I want to tell you this. I want all of us this morning, by hearing this passage, to gaze on his glory. You're a believer, gaze on his glory. You're not a believer, look at who he is. Look on his glory, how he has revealed it. And trust in him. Only trust in him. If he is who he says he is, then your best is with him, and he is calling you to himself. Psalm 34:8, oh, taste and see, friends, that the Lord, that Yahweh is good. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him. Let's pray.